Chris, how's it shaped
out? I think the October surprise is going to be the president. I think he's going to campaign like mad for Hillary, because he needs to, because his legacy is at stake and it's fragile. He wants to save Obamacare, he wants to save his record on everything from voting rights to everything else, and Hillary will do it for him. It's an interesting deal. I think it's already been sewed up. He'll campaign like gangbusters all through October. He'll bring out the minority vote like mad, because it's easier to campaign for somebody else than yourself. It's more fun. And I think you're going to see an amazing uptick. Obama, because he's been out of the limelight politically, he's up to the mid-50s now in acceptability or approval. He's really come up, and it always happens when you get out of the political limelight. And the candidates have taken that limelight away from him. So he's gotten more popular. He'll be more popular if the economy just does what it's doing right now through September. He'll come out there campaign like mad for her. She's not a great campaigner, we know that. Bill Clinton's a little tired at it, but she'll be good at it with him. I think it's going to be a hell of a political pair, and I think she'll win handily. And the reason she'll win, because people will say, I'm not taking this big chance on Trump. It's too big a chance. And Hillary's not exciting, but she's predictably what she is, which we've watched her for 20, 30 years. She's at two notches to the right of the president on foreign policy, which bugs me. I wish it was just a notch. She's much more hawkish, but people want a little more hawkish, I think. Now, just a little more. A little more. And on domestic policy, she's about where he is. I don't think Bernie's where the country is. If you're a student with a loan, he's where you're at. But you're a parent with a student with a loan. But generally, I think he's the president's about a little left of the country by a notch or two. But I think Hillary will sort of fit in right spot. Not exciting. She'll be great in the debates, because she's always great if the questions are predictable. She's brilliant at predictable questions. Trump will say wild things, but you can't come into one of these presidential debates with that hair and there's no applause, really. There's no big loud, you know, peanut gallery kind of applause. There's a little smattering of it. That won't be the circus he likes to be in. Hillary will like it. It'll be very PBS. You know what I mean, Mark?
I do. Thank you, Chris. I know you intended that as a compliment.
Well, no, I wouldn't be alive if it was a PBS world, but that's all right. No, but it'll be very sober, serious, and Hillary will be great at it. She's very smart, and you watch her getting prepared by people, I know who they are, Bob Barnett and people like that. They all sit down with her, and she's great at it. And I don't think it's going to be a lot of crazy questions, so I think she'll do very well. And he'll seem a little strange at some point this fall. But all that said, I do think Trump was onto something big this year, really big. He had something to say. His opponents had nothing to say. Yeah. And he talked to the American people. You may not like the way he talked. He said terrible things, dunce cap stuff, like Rafael Cruz was involved with killing Jack Kennedy. Horrible things he said. Mm-hmm. And that's something a head of state in this country, and that's one of the titles he's going for, must never say. And he doesn't seem to know there's things you must, are ineffable. Never say that somebody's part of a Kennedy assassination. Never. Don't talk about that. That was a part of our history, which is still we're recovering from. And when he talked about that as something from the National Enquirer, and the guy's he's reading the National Enquirer for his information. Reader's Digest was the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's horrible that he actually thought it, and someone of his opponents says he believes this stuff when he says it. That's scarier than being a liar.
But Chris, you know...
Don't interrupt that great thought, okay?
Oh,
that great thought. You stopped on my line there. Just give me... Count to three. One,
two three. Go.
Here's a brace.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, finish your thought.
No, I had it.
Now you made me free. Oh, Hillary was... Donald Trump was not good at these Republican debates. What was interesting to me, after every Republican debate, I'd walk away and say, gee, Donald Trump didn't really have a great night. When they were talking about details of substance, he kind of backed off, and he wasn't very involved in it. And so my question to you is whether that can occur when there are just two of you on the stage. And it's Hillary Clinton, who is all about doing her homework and substance and everything else. And Donald Trump, who is all about something else.
Yeah, Chris, along those lines, and all of you, I mean, speak to this phenomenon, because the reality is that those of us, you know, that know Bernie Sanders, 74-year-old socialist, who, you know, wasn't that involved on the House side. When I served with him on the Senate side, was kind of isolated. Nobody ever expected that he would come out and have the appeal that he's had. And Trump, the same thing. Everybody wrote Trump off. And so there is something going on in this country in which there are a lot of angry, frustrated people who are responding to Trump's, you know, histrionics, what he's saying, what he's doing, and the same thing in many ways to Sanders and what he's, you know, addressing. So what is that something, that pulse out there? What, you know, define it for us.
Well, I think one part of it is, now, if you're very progressive, you'll hate hearing this, but it's true for both Bernie and Trump, a sense of joy. When people come out of those rallies, I don't know if that's the right word, they're happy. They feel like they've done something. And Trump talks to the person who's frustrated in a different way than Bernie does. The most people out there say, life's been tough. Not this audience, maybe, but a lot of people go, life's been pretty rough on me. I've lost a few jobs. I may be divorced. Things haven't worked. Kids aren't doing that well. They're not launching. And life's, for a lot of people, is rough. And it usually has to do with the workplace. It has to do with the ability to make a living in this country. And things have changed. We've lost a lot of technology. I mean, we've lost a lot of manufacturing. All that's changed. We've been... So Trump comes to that guy, usually a white guy, and he says something to the guy. You haven't failed. Your country has failed you. Don't feel bad. We've been shoved around by the damn Russians who tell us what they want to do to us in Eastern Europe, and they talk about their gas and everything else they got, and they shove us around. The damn Chinese do the same to us. They manipulate their currency, manipulate us. They sell their stuff to us. We can't sell anything to them. The Arabs won't pay for the price of fighting terrorism. You don't even know if they're in it or not. They won't lift a finger. We got to send our boys over there and our women over there. Look, the Mexicans think they can laugh at our border. The Canadians, well, they got Ted Cruz. I mean, he goes after everybody. He knocks, he talks as a nationalist. Our country's been shoved around. It's not just you. Our country's been shoved around by everybody. The Europeans won't pay for NATO. We've got to pay for it. We got to pay for everything. South Korea's defense. We're paying for everything. We're chumps. We're getting shoved around. And I'm going to shove back. And the average guy out there has been voting for that. And you may not like it, but there's a gut to it. Hillary's got no gut message. But that guy's got a gut message. When he says make America, I understand what offends people, because sometimes people think, oh, it means the early 50s, the all white power structure. But it's, I think it's something else. It's a sense of America being what it was coming out of World War II, the country that won. It won. And I think he sells it, and he's crude and terrible, and he says things about people. So I don't want to defend him, except maybe the monkey type Merry Christmas here. Maybe somehow this guy said the thing that connects with a lot of working guys out there. So going into the general, there are not enough working guys like that to win for him. One time I was working as a cop on Capitol Hill. It was my first job before I got all these fancy jobs, and I was a patronage cop. And I hung out with a lot of West Virginia guys, what do you call it, double dippers. I got to know them. And one guy, Leroy Taylor, had been an MP. And Leroy called me aside. I was the college kid. And he called me aside and he said, you know why the little man loves this country, Chris? Because it's all he's got. I've never forgotten that. That gut patriotism of the working guy. And Trump, fairly or not, has tapped into that gut patriotism. Nationalism, it's the America before the Declaration of Independence, before the Constitution, before any of that good stuff. It's the America we took from the Indians. That's what he's rooting for. That's who Trump talks to, that nationalism. The country we took, this place. We own it, and we're going to fight for it. He knows how to talk, and it's not going to be 50%, but fascinating bit of history we're living through, I think.
JC? You know, Chris, that's a great assessment. That gut, speaking to the gut, and you know, I can look at the last 10 years and I understand people's anger. I'm mad. I remember the 2008 meltdown during that time when we had investment bankers, we had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that was running amok. And I had led the charge for 5, 6, 7 years trying to get reforms with Fannie and Freddie. And the argument was, if ever there's a blip in the housing market, Fannie and Freddie would destabilize the greatest economy in the world. Well, we had a blip in the housing market, and then you looked at it up and down the food chain. People were distorting appraisals. I mean, you know, putting people in homes that should have been $500 a month. It was $1,500, $1,700 a month, and it went on and on and on. And you know what? At the end of the day, people were upside down in homes. Their credit scores were ruined. Their credit was ruined. And, you know, everybody that was involved in that, they walked. So I understand that anger. But on the flip side of that coin, with someone like me, I'm concerned how we deal with our anger. When you have, I understand, appealing to the gut, and again, it's a great assessment, but appealing to the gut and saying to someone, you know, punch them in the mouth and I'll pay the legal bills. When you disagree with someone, you're just a liars, and you kind of take on a bully's mentality. And for someone, I said earlier today, I just released my second book on March 7th, Dig Deep, Seven Truths of Finding the Strength Within. And yes, that's a shameless plug for you to go buy it. But the fact is, and I said to my colleagues earlier, there's no one in Washington, Republican or Democrat, that would consider me a hostile black guy or an angry black guy. I just know words matter. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's the biggest lie that's ever come down the pipe. Words do hurt. Words do matter. And when you take just 2 years ago, not 20 years ago, but 2 years ago, I'm in a department store, and I'm being profiled, and I established that this security guy was following me, and I finally turned around and I said, "Sir, are you following me?" And he said, "I'm doing my job." I said, "Is your job to follow me?" He said, "I'm doing my job." And so I walked on, I went back, and I said, "Sir, my wife and I, we're in this store. People know us here. We, you know," I said, I'm in this store all the time." He said, "I don't care if you're the president." I don't know if he meant the president of the United States or the president of the company. So I wanted to talk to a manager. I talked to the manager. I told her what had happened. She said, "Yeah, Mr. Watts, you and your wife, we see you in here all the time." Well, I went and talked to this gentleman, and when I went to meet him, all of a sudden, he came to me, he ran to me and said, "Oh, Mr. Watts, I'm so sorry. I said, "Sir, I accept your apology." I said, "But I want you to know I've got kids, I've got grandkids. I would hate for them to come in this store and have to go through the humiliation that you put me through in the last 20 minutes. Is what Mr. Trump's saying, is it encouraging that type of thing? I think you have to think about it." Yeah, I think about it, not from a point of anger to say that you're a bad guy if someone, my dad was a police officer. So I'm not throwing police officers under the bus. I'm just saying that somebody has to be the adult and stand up and be responsible. And I just think some of the things he does is just totally irresponsible. And we all are going to end up paying a price if we don't speak out on it and say, "Hey, let's appeal to the best of who we are on both sides. Let's appeal to the best of who we are as a nation, not the worst of who we are." And I tell you, I've seen some not so good things on both sides of the aisle in this presidential election, and it concerns me deeply.
Mark, what's happening out there in the country?
Well, I just say this about Donald Trump. Don't worry if he gets elected. Seriously, because it'll only be a matter of months before he leaves us for a younger country.
Shields, we're going to send you to bed with no dinner.
I want to say this, though, in not in defense of Trump, but in defense of those who vote for Trump. And that's this. We just had a Navy SEAL killed, Charles Keating IV. And he was the grandson of Charles Keating of Lincoln Federal Savings and Loan. For those who remember the savings and loan scandal, Charles Keating, the owner of Lincoln's Federal Savings and Loan, went to jail for 4 years. 1,100 people went to jail in the savings and loan scandal, which was 1/25th the size of the bailout. And we sit here today, and not a single one has ever been brought to the bar of justice. And Donald Trump is saying there have been trade deals, and yes, the big picture on trade is impressive. Trade has raised more people out of poverty, and it's remarkable. But there's collateral damage. There's collateral damage. If you go today to Ohio, or you go today to Michigan, you go today to Pennsylvania, you're going to see burnt out towns and communities where the jobs have gone and the futures have gone. And Donald Trump is saying, look, you've been screwed by the government. The top 1% has walked. We saw what happened in 2008, as JC described it, and the response of the federal government was, we must find out who did this and give them $800 billion. And nobody bailed out somebody who's behind in their mortgage, people who have been foreclosed on. And so there is a sense that the deals have been cut, the investment class has done very well on the trade business, but the people who played by the rules, whose kids joined the military and served, whose kids have gone sometimes 4 or 5 tours in the Middle East, in Iraq, in a war that we have no idea what would be victory. We know it's been going on for 15 years. We know there has been no consistent, understandable national leadership on it. We know that there is no sense of national mission. We know it violates America's great rule that war demands equality of sacrifice. We know that all the sacrifice, all the suffering is being borne by less than 1% of Americans. That none of us have paid an extra dime in taxes. We've just gone along as business as usual. And these are the people from whose families and communities and neighborhoods the casualties are coming. The casualties in the economic, the trade picture, the casualties in the war that has no end in sight, or no victory to be determined. The Congress of the United States will not even vote to authorize the use of military force. And so there is a sense, and he's saying, you matter. You matter. Now, I may be the only person who will ever join in the same sentence Franklin Roosevelt and Donald Trump. When Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945 in Warm Springs, Georgia, the train brought his caisson back to Washington, D.C.'s Union Station. And the streets of Washington were lined 15 deep as the horses drew the casket from Union Station to the White House. 15 deep, and people were openly crying in a time when Americans didn't show emotions. And the only record we have of it are the print reporters and radio. And a CBS radio reporter saw an very well-dressed man. And he was standing in the street as President Roosevelt's caisson went by, the horse drawn. And he was crying. And he said, excuse me, sir, did you know the president? He said, no, I didn't know the president, but he knew me. And, you know, that's a test of a president. Does he know? Does he know the hopes, the heart, the fears of the people he seeks to lead, or she seeks to lead. So that's...
Well, you're also making the case for Bernie Sanders, by the way, because it is the same discussion when I was in Iowa and New Hampshire and onward with voters. What I was hearing from them, some of whom were deciding between Sanders and Trump, I might add, was that same sense that they had been that they had been absolutely left behind. I think the difference is, and this is a question about optimism, and the question is whether Sanders is more optimistic than Trump is.
Trump is both optimistic and pessimistic. I mean, he really is. I mean, no, he is. He's both. I mean, you know, I mean, he really is pessimistic about the assessment of where we are, and then sort of this unexplained make America great again. But the idea that of the Trump-Sanders overlay, forget it. Okay, I worked in 1972 for President Muskie. You remember President Muskie? I personally took him from 65% approval to 11%. So that fall, George McGovern is the nominee. And he picks Tom Eagleton as his vice presidential nominee. And then there's this close that Tom Eagleton has had electric shock treatments, and he's forced to resign from the ticket. So I have a chance to work. Sergeant Shriver, one of the most admirable human beings I've ever known in a public life or private life, was picked for the hostage position of being George McGovern's running mate. All we talked to, and this will be an example of Trump, all we talked to that year were Democrats who were disaffected. We talked to Catholics, to Jews, to Eastern Europeans, to Latin. I mean, that's always so. We never saw a white American Protestant in the whole campaign. And I say that because Pat Caddell, who was the boy genius of George McGovern's polling, had a cockamamie theory that the Wallace vote was available to McGovern, that there was an overlay, because they were both appealing to the alienated, to the outsider. And if there are three Bernie Sanders people in America who vote for Donald Trump, I'll buy you a steak dinner. I really will.
we're going to turn to the questions from the audience, but before I do that, let me just ask JC, what happens to the Republican Party? You know, as you know, we go through this. There's obviously a lot of turmoil now, as you've said. Trump is supposed to meet with the speaker, and that doesn't look like it's going to be a pleasant meeting. He's already said, I'm not going to change my mind, and you know, it doesn't look like that'll change. As a matter of fact, he suggested that the speaker should not head up the Republican convention. So the party, you know, is obviously split right now. If assuming that Trump loses, what happens to the Republican Party?
Well, I think the way Mr. Trump approached the Paul Ryan situation, considering that Paul only said, he didn't say he wouldn't endorse him. He said, I'm not there yet. We need to talk. He'd never talked to Mr. Trump. He just said, I want to see where we are. How can we, or where are we together on things? How do we reconcile our differences? I want to have that conversation. And Mr. Trump immediately went to saying he can't chair the convention. So, Mr. Secretary, I'm really not concerned about my party. I'm concerned about my country. And you know, we can figure out the party thing at some point in time. But when you consider that, you know, we've talked about the amount of debt that we have as a nation. We've set $19 trillion. I would probably submit to you that we're closer to $50 trillion in debt. We've got deficits as far as I can see. We're not talking about how we better educate our kids. We're not talking about infrastructure in the country. How do we get back? to where we need to be in terms of our infrastructure. We do have some national security issues that we need to deal with. We're not talking about those things. We're underperforming in our economy. We're not talking about those things. And this unrest now with Republicans, the focus right now is on Republicans. But I would submit to you that this unrest didn't just start in the last 7 years. I would take you back to 1992 with Ross Perot in the first in the Bush-Clinton election of 1992. That was more on the Republican side. But fast forward to 2004, Howard Dean. We saw it on the Democrat side when everybody early said that he would probably be the nominee. And he had so much energy going for him that if you all recall, Vice President Gore, Joseph Lieberman was Vice President Gore's running mate. Senator Lieberman, he was running for president, and Vice President Gore endorsed Howard Dean over his running mate because that's where the energy was, and it looked like he was going to win. So I don't think it's just emerged or emerged the last 7-8 years. I think it's been brewing for probably more than 20 years. Mr. Trump and Bernie Sanders has just tapped into it at the right time. And Trump's gotten a nomination, and Sanders is still fighting. I think he's going to lose it, but nevertheless, he's still in the game.
Okay, let me take a break here before we get to the questions from the audience. And as always, I'd like to recognize the members of the question review team, the people that are responsible for selecting the questions that I'll present to our speakers. And if you'll hold your applause, let me introduce them. Chelsea Adami, who's public safety reporter for the Salinas Californian, Julie Copeland, who's city editor for the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KAZU Radio, and Claudia Melendez, who's education reporter for the Monterey Herald. If you would thank them, please, I would appreciate it. We also have a group of students representing those who attended this afternoon's program. It was a great program with our speakers. At this time, I'd like to ask all of the students in attendance if they would stand, and please remain standing until I recognize the schools that are present. There are six schools that are here being represented, so if you'll rise. Central Coast High School, the Defense Language Institute, Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, the Navy Postgraduate School, San Jose State University, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. Thank you all very much. All right, questions. If you're not inclined to vote for either the Democrat or the Republican nominee, what's the best way to get a third-party candidate on the ballot who has a fair chance of winning? Chris?
Well, I don't like third-party candidates, so I'm not going to help you. I'm serious. Now, look, I think it's, most people think it's too late right now. It is technically, I think there's a couple deadlines that are coming fast, but I haven't heard a whole lot about it happening this year. And I do think that when you go for a third-party candidate, you have to accept the collateral damage. You're basically killing the candidate you otherwise would have voted for. And I've watched this. And I heard earlier today Mark made a case for Perot, and nobody made a case for Ralph Nader yet. It does change the results. And in the end, the way our system works, you have to get 270 electoral votes, or else it goes to the House. And if you want that, I think you're crazy. If you want the House of Representatives to pick our next president, under a unit rule of each state getting a vote. So New York, California, by the way, gets one vote. One vote. Rhode Island gets one, you get one. Idaho gets one, you get one. So it's a crazy way to pick a president. So you want to have one of the two candidates, a candidate to get 270 electoral votes. And I think a strong opponent, like somebody like Bloomberg gets in this thing, he might carry Connecticut, but that could screw it up. He may carry a couple states. I don't know. I wouldn't think he'd get more than two or three.
No.
I don't see it.
No.
You think he'd get none?
He doesn't get zero.
Okay, thank you. I was going low here, Mark, and you're going lower than me. I mean, some people get in their head, oh, Bloomberg's big time. You know, back east, that's how they think of the West as being somewhere out past Jersey, you know. I agree. Okay, I'm with you, Mark. We're down to two or three states. I'll say one. Okay, but the fact is, I don't know who would do well in a third-party race. I mean, I think Governor Petraeus, General Petraeus, was a he's a very impressive guy, but he got in trouble with that relationship. I think he was very impressive, somebody that could shake things up. But Colin Powell never went that way. He never went third party or second party, Republican. He didn't do it. So I'm just not happy with this. I don't know any Teddy Roosevelts today.
You know,
and even he screwed it up for his party and gave it to Wilson. So what if you have the greatest third party candidate ever, gave it to the other party, and that's what ends up happening. If that's what you want to do, just admit it and vote for the Democrat.
There's a group that's actually trying to do it, and one of the people involved is an ultra conservative, Eric Erickson. Who used to run redstate.com.
He doesn't have a candidate.
And this is the problem. So I was talking to him the other day, and he's like, well, we got all these people. The problem is they don't have a candidate.
No.
Because they keep going to candidate after candidate, and nobody really wants to do it. They thought at one point that Rick Perry might do it. But Rick Perry just announced the other day that he's for Trump, and if he were named vice president, he'd be honored to serve.
So, right. And be happy to have a job.
But they've thrown several names around. Rick Perry, you've heard Tom Coburn out of Oklahoma, and several others that you've heard. And I think, Gloria, that group is kind of evolving to, under no circumstances Trump, but go vote and vote down line.
Well, at this stage of the game, you'd have to just write in the name. There's no way to put together an effective third party operation that's going to be able to compete in each state.
I do want to say something good about Rick Perry. Okay, one of the great things about our business is you get to see people, and it overcomes. It either confirms or repeals what your sort of prejudice or perception is going in. Rick Perry turned out to have a great sense of humor.
Yes.
Okay, he ran for president in 2012 and ran badly. But he told a story about, he said he couldn't figure out why he'd done so badly. He's talking off the record with a group of reporters, and he said, I just don't know why I did. He said, I've been governor longer than anybody in the history of Texas. Never lost an election. I was an Air Force pilot. I went to Texas A&M. I majored in animal husbandry. He says, maybe that's the problem, animal husbandry. He says, that's what Rick Santorum thinks same-sex marriage is going to lead to. You got to like a guy like that. I mean, you really do.
All right.
Just one quick thing on the Republican Party, and that is what Trump understood is, and the rest of us, me, what I missed, was there were sort of certain principles the Republican Party stood
That's
for.
That's right.
Okay? Republican Party stood for free trade. Republican Party stood for liberalized immigration. Republican Party stood for muscular defense policy, interventionist if necessary. Republican Party stood for taming entitlements. Might have to take some of the beautiful gray hairs out of Social Security. And what did Donald Trump stand for? He stood for the opposite on every one of those issues. He basically confronted what was the Republican creed and said no, and he won. I mean, so to this guy, it is a significant political achievement. When you say what's going to happen to the Republican Party, I don't know what's going to happen to the Republican Party, but it will never be the same as it's been.
No.
There'll never be those assumptions again that, oh boy, we're all for free trade and we got to tame. I mean, what's he say? I will make sure that Social Security there's not a dime changed in it. You'll get every nickel that you're promised and even more. And Medicare will be funded completely and we're not going into any more wars. He's just across the board.
And maybe I'll raise taxes on the wealthy.
And maybe I'll raise taxes on the wealthy.
But you know, in
and the minimum wage.
Yeah, right. And I've got a theory. I've done taxes. I don't think you need more taxes. I think you need more taxpayers. And so you've got to do something to create, to create jobs. But secondly, even before Trump, I think Republicans were struggling with who they are.
Yeah, there's some truth to that. I think you're right.
I think the brand has been tarnished. You know, if you see yellow arches, you think McDonald's. You see red roofs, you think You know, Pizza Hut, there used to be taxes. I mean, it used to be with the Republicans, you thought a certain thing. And I even believe before Donald Trump, you know, we were struggling saying, who are we? And I believe that's why, again, Trump has kind of picked up the mantle. I agree with you that his agenda would not be considered a Republican agenda. But I was a Rand Paul supporter, and Rand Paul, you know, Muhammad Ali said, you know, if you're the same man at 50 that you were at 20, he said, you wasted 30 years. Well, the fact is, Rand Paul was saying to Republicans, look, let's learn from what we've done over the last 15 years in Iraq and around the country. You know, I was with him in saying that, hey, I don't say that we should never engage, but I think we need to rethink how we engage. And Rand Paul didn't make it. Rand Paul was talking about poverty. He was talking about incarceration reform, which I've been talking about since 1996, with the disparity on crack cocaine and powder cocaine. That I, when I peeled the onion on that, it was basically, you know, Wall Street types used powder cocaine, Main Street kids, folks use crack cocaine. So we finally got something done on that 5 years after I left, and maybe I was a problem, but we did get something done on it. So Rand Paul was talking about some things that was a little different to be talking about in a Republican primary.
You're right.